Welcome to my backyard. We have new outdoor space, so I'm taking advantage of it to talk to you about Supreme Court expansion. I am surprisingly confident, I'd say, surprising to myself, surprisingly confident that should there be a Democratic trifecta in 2029, and a trifecta just means that Democrats control the White House, the Senate, and the House of Representatives. Should they control a trifecta in 2029, I am reasonably confident that there will be at least an attempt to expand the size of the Supreme Court, most likely to 13 justices. I say that because if you've been paying attention to what high-ranking and ambitious Democrats have been saying over the last few months, this seems to be a mounting consensus within the Democratic Party that there needs to be Supreme Court reform and that court expansion ought to be on the list, and that of the possible court expansion options, a straightforward expansion of four justices would make the most sense. Kamala Harris recently came out saying that she supports court expansion.
We need to revisit the point of expanding the court to 13 justices like we have 13 district courts.
And so did Pete Buttigieg.
Nowhere in the Constitution does it say that there have to be 9 Supreme Court justices. That one doesn't even take a constitutional amendment. It just takes a readiness to set up a court that fits this country. We could have 13 seats matching the district structure of the federal judiciary, but also a process that makes it less partisan.
They don't hold office, but they will likely run for president, and that gives you a sense of where they think the middle of the party might be. And on Sunday, Representative Jim Clyburn of South Carolina, top-ranking Democrat in the House, highly influential member of the party whose endorsement in the South Carolina Democratic primary carries real weight, endorsed court expansion to 13 justices.
I think that we are in a position now that calls from some significant actions taken by the Congress, and we ought to expand it. And 13 is a pretty good number. A baker's dozen will be a good number to have on the court.
That's major. That really is a major shift. That suggests that there's real appetite for it in the House leadership, which means there will likely be some appetite for it in Senate Democratic leadership. And in the upcoming presidential contest, it puts pressure on candidates to at least meet Clyburn's initial bid. Now, there's a real question to ask here, what changed? Because you'll recall, in the first year of Biden's term, he had a Supreme Court commission. And that commission sidestepped the question of court reform, didn't really even try to push it, and Biden didn't push it either. So what has changed between now and then? The Supreme Court's 2022 decision in Dobbs v. Jackson Women's Health, I think it's played a role. But I think the most significant change happened this year, and you can just use one word to sum it up, one noun, technically, Calais. That's the Supreme Court's decision in Louisiana v. Calais, which effectively destroyed what was left of the Voting Rights Act, which took a major blow in 2013 with Shelby County v. Holder. Now, I've talked about Calais a lot on this YouTube page. I'm not going to go on a long tangent about it, but I'll say the basics. The main thing Calais did was invalidate Congress's 1982 amendment to the Voting Rights Act, which redefined what it took to prove racial discrimination in voting. Congress at the time thought that it was too hard, too much to prove intent. Intent is very difficult. Very few people write on paper that they're planning to racially discriminate. Instead, Congress said we would look at results. Did this voting change work to discriminate against people? And if it did, then it was suspect. In 84, the Supreme Court, interpreting this amendment, held that it was permissible to make majority-minority districts under this results test. The main holding of Calais is to invalidate all of that and to invalidate those majority-minority districts. The author of the ruling, Sam Alito, argues that those majority-minority districts violate the Equal Protection Clause of the 14th Amendment, and that instead, state legislators ought to be permitted to create districts in which Black Americans, or any racial minority that is a sizable group, cannot elect a representative of their choosing. Now, from my perspective, and I know I'm not going to go on a tangent, I promise. I promise this won't be a tangent. From my perspective, this is nonsensical. It cannot violate equal protection. The clause written to protect the rights of Black Americans, to adopt measures specifically meant to protect the rights of Black Americans. An interpretation of the 14th Amendment that says that the 14th Amendment makes it illegal to try to ameliorate past racial discrimination, that makes it illegal to try to ameliorate the effects of a lack of representation. If your understanding of the 14th Amendment leads to that conclusion, I think it's just straightforwardly wrong. And beyond that, to people who might say that these majority-minority districts are just racial entitlements, they're unfair, the fact of the matter is that these districts aren't pieced together. They represent coherent communities of interest. And I happen to think that in a state like Louisiana, where Black Americans are close to a third of the population, or Alabama, where they're a quarter, or Mississippi, where they're 40%, I happen to think that in those states, communities of interest, if those communities of interest have distinct political interests relative to the majority, I think they should be able to elect a representative of their choosing. I don't think it's racial discrimination to allow those communities to elect a representative of their choosing. There's no requirement they have to elect a Black person, but they are able to elect someone who represents their interests. Supreme Court thinks differently. Supreme Court thinks that's racial discrimination and is thus verboten under the 14th Amendment. The court believes that recognizing the existence of those communities of interest is itself a form of racial discrimination, which, I'm going to be honest, is the stupidest thing I've ever heard. But no tangent. I promise this is not a tangent. So that's what Calais says. The one last point to make about Calais is it also holds that the Supreme Court and not Congress has the right to determine what constitutes appropriate legislation under the 15th Amendment, which takes a tremendous amount of power from Congress and hands it directly to the court. Calais, in its holding and its implications, doesn't just threaten the political representation of Black Americans, it threatens the power of the people who represent them, people like Jim Clyburn. And by extension, because Black Americans are this critical constituency within the Democratic Party, it also threatens the political viability of the Democratic Party. It is really a system-level threat to the Democratic Party. And so it stands to reason that there would be mounting energy to do something about the Supreme Court that produced Calais. And I think that explains so much of the change. The court right now is arrogant and power drunk and believes that it is untouchable. And as such, it is moving and operating in ways to aggrandize itself, help its allies in the Republican Party, implement its insane and monarchical theories of executive power, and generally just act as a menace to a free and thriving society. John Roberts, Sam Alito, and Clarence Thomas in particular look at the Reconstruction Amendments and say to themselves, we hate those things and we want them gone or at least invalidated as much as possible.
I want to shoot you so bad. My dick's hard.
That maybe was an inappropriate cutaway, but I think it's pretty funny and I like that movie, so here we are. All the evidence right now suggests that if they're given a chance, Democrats will attempt to expand the Supreme Court. Doesn't mean that they will succeed, but I think an attempt is baked into the cake. One thing I would say is that in addition to expanding the court, there needs to be a push to expand the entire federal judiciary, not just the Supreme Court. The circuit courts, and the appeals courts as well. The reason for this is first to dilute the Trump effect on the courts. Trump has appointed hundreds of judges at this point to dilute their impact as much as possible. But there's a practical reason as well. It's been almost 50 years since we've had a meaningful lower court expansion. In that time, the population of the U.S. has grown by more than a third. And the courts themselves routinely speak of huge backlogs in their work. It takes years for a case to go to trial. This is not just a burden on the courts, but it is a burden on people's ability to get justice. It is arguably a violation of the constitutional right to a speedy trial. We literally need more courts. We need more people doing this work. And so I actually think court reform, Supreme Court reform, should be a larger project, a complete overhaul of the entire federal judiciary, in addition to putting new regulations and reforms on the Supreme Court. I actually have a lot more to say about expanding the entire federal judiciary. I think there's a lot of reasons beyond the technical aspects and the political aspects to do it. And I think there are critical reforms to implement as well. We need to end jurisdiction shopping, for example. But that'll be a separate video. For now, the point of this is to say, I think there's a pretty good chance that court expansion happens. And the task right now is to be loud about this when it comes to your elected representatives and to begin building and to insist that this will not be enough, that at this stage, four new justices is the minimum. and that there needs to be a larger project reforming the Supreme Court and the entire federal judiciary. As always, let me know what you think. Thank you for watching, and I will see you next time.